facts, candid conversations, and some levity to lighten your day. This is The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
A wonderful Wednesday to you. So glad that you're with me on the show. 1-888-914-9149 is the number to call. You can also email me, and you can email some questions if you want us to answer a question on the show. It's great to hear from you guys, and we have lots of questions that come in, and we love those. We can't answer every question, but we promise that we will answer as many as possible, and we always pray for everyone who contacts the show via Twitter, via email. So the email address is Cale, C-A-L-E, at relevantradio.com, and my Twitter handle is at Cale Clark. You can tweet at me. You can shoot me a question. We'll try to get it on the air. And the show account is at Cale Clark Show. So the phone number to call, 1-888-914-9149. And producer Lucas Holt is in the car right now. I know he's listening to the show. He might even call in. He's on a sort of a day off tape. He's kind of working. He's dropping things off at our Chicago studios and driving back and forth. He might even call in. I don't know, but Patrick Alog is with me today. Hey, Patrick, how's it going?
Hey, Cale. Hey. I'm coming in for the bullpen here today.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's great to have you on board. And you're going to be guest producing today. And I can't wait because we've got a lot of cool topics to talk about. One of them involves the Ark, Raiders of the Lost Ark, one of my favorite films, Indiana Jones. Got some music for me? It's there somewhere. In the archives. There it is. And as you guys know, I've done a lot of archaeological work in Israel, working on digs, and I just love it. And of course, one of the great themes of Raiders of the Lost Ark is trying to find the Ark of the Covenant. And if you see in the film, don't worry, your face isn't going to melt off like that Nazi guy who saw the Ark. And but we are going to talk about the Ark because there's been some recent research that has been done to answer the question, why did the Ark look the way that it did? Why did it have that particular shape? Why was it in this particular box? Why were the angels on top with their wings outstretched? Well, some really great clues have come down to us from Egypt, because, of course, the Israelites went out of Egypt to the Promised Land. And so we're going to take a look at that later in the show. Plus, I'm going to answer Mary from Chicago's question. She called in right at the end of the show last night. And she asked me the question, how come in the Hail Holy Queen prayer it says, after this our exile, show unto us the blessed fruit of thy womb, Jesus? Well, what does the exile part mean? I didn't quite get to answer that. I answered it really, really briefly yesterday. And I promised Mary, so if you're listening, Mary from Chicago, I'm going to give you hopefully a much better and more satisfying answer also later in the program. So you're going to want to hang on for that. And one writer that's really been quite beloved by me and so many others is Clive Staples Lewis, C.S. Lewis. And C.S. Lewis never did become a Catholic. I think there's some interesting reasons why. But he believed a lot of Catholic stuff. And of course, he was a convert from atheism to Christianity. And he's written some very, very powerful works, such as Mere Christianity. We're going to talk about that in just a moment. Maybe his most overlooked book that he ever wrote was called The Abolition of Man. And next week on The Cale Clark Show, I'm going to be joined by Father Michael Ward, who's written a book about C.S. Lewis's book, A Book About a Book. And it's all about how this is so relevant to our time today. I think you're really going to enjoy this interview. That's going to happen next week. We'll give you more details on that as we get closer. But one thing I wanted to talk to you guys about is, why is it that C.S. Lewis became a Christian in the first place? Why did he leave atheism behind? Well, there's another person who's written a sort of a three-part biography of C.S. Lewis called Harry Lee Poe. And he wrote a little piece about this, how C.S. Lewis came to this slow journey to belief in Jesus. And it had a lot to do with really, the reasons why, even though he never really gave his personal testimony, he was asked to do this. The book, Mere Christianity, we could talk about that book a little bit more in more detail later on, but this book, Mere Christianity, which has been read by millions, it's one of my favorites. I read it when I was coming to faith in Jesus. It really did help me a lot. were based. This book was based on broadcast radio talks that he gave on BBC Radio, the last of this four-part series he did in 1944. And it was really successful. It was during World War II times. And the BBC wanted him to come back on. And they kept prodding him, can you please do more broadcasts on other subjects? And he said, no, no, not going to do it. He politely declined. I'm done making radio talks. And he was asked, okay, well, how about this? The BBC said, if you don't want to do talks on more issues, can you at least give us your personal testimony, your personal journey to faith? Why did you leave atheism behind and embrace Christ? And he said, well, I'm not the sort of person who gives one's personal testimony, and I really don't want to do that, because if I did, it would just sound really repetitious. And as Harry Lee Poe explains in his article, in actuality, C.S. Lewis had already shared his personal testimony about how he left atheism and came to Christ, and he actually did it in his radio broadcast, but he never said, I'm giving my personal journey. Basically, these talks that became the book Mere Christianity, that was his personal journey to faith, but he told it from the third person point of view. He didn't talk about himself. He didn't say, I struggled with this. And if you read that book, and if you listen to those radio talks, I'm sure there's copies of it out there on YouTube somewhere. C.S. Lewis didn't try to create an argument for the existence of God or what kind of God he is, why the incarnation makes sense, why Jesus is God in the flesh. What he did was he talked about, even though he didn't say, these are my reasons why I came to faith, they were his reasons, how he came to believe that Jesus is the Son of God. And he didn't sort of take the straw man argument approach where he set up this hypothetical straw man and then easily knocked it down with his brilliant arguments. He didn't really use a debate style. If he were sitting around maybe the Eagle and Child pub in Oxford with J.R.R. Tolkien or some other friends, he might have talked about it this way. Or if he was debating people at Magdalen College, where he taught at Oxford, or if he was on stage at the Socratic Debating Club with somebody else who he was having an argument with, a debate with, a public debate, he probably would have handled it a little bit differently. But in these radio talks, he wasn't combative, he wasn't belligerent, he was very friendly in his approach. And it was almost as if he was telling all the listeners, who he considered his friends, hey, I've got this problem, and I'm going to try to talk it through with you on the radio, because I know that many people listening have this problem as well. And a lot of what he talked about on the radio, on the BBC, apparently he also dealt with this in his book called The Problem of Pain. And a lot of what's in Mere Christianity, according to Harry Lee Poe, is from The Problem of Pain, the opening of The Problem of Pain. And how did C.S. Lewis descend into atheism anyways when he was a young man? Well, it kind of all started with the death of his mother. And when his mother passed away, he questioned God. How could you let this happen? How could you let her die? And I think that's true of a lot of people. They have some tragic event in life. They can't understand why God would allow it. And that's what leads them down a path towards atheism. But once he got there, once C.S. Lewis became an atheist, the one thing that kept gnawing at him, the one thing that he just couldn't reconcile with atheism, was the problem of good and evil. Because he was basically a materialist at this point. And when he was in his early 20s, he really bought into the views of Sigmund Freud. And Freud, of course, taught that God was only a psychological projection. And there's no such thing. This is something that people make up to try to explain things away. And if you're a staunch materialist, if you think that really all that matters is matter, all that exists is matter, only the physical universe, only the physical world is real, well, then there really can't be any good or evil. There really can't be right or wrong. There really can't be true beauty or true ugliness, for that matter. There is only what is. There's no such thing as values. There's no such thing as right and wrong, because right and wrong are not materialistic. They're not made up of material. They're not made up of atoms. And so this was what was on C.S. Lewis's mind after he came back from World War One, the Great War, when he came back to Oxford after serving in World War One. And how did he get from being this young atheist studying at Oxford in the UK to being this incredible apologist, defending the faith, explaining the faith on the radio, on the BBC, and later on, of course, in his many books? Well, here's how it all got started. C.S. Lewis started teaching philosophy in the year 1924, and he was basically a substitute teacher for his old philosophy professor. And he said, here's what I'm going to do in the class. I'm going to start a project, and I'm going to try to prove in my lectures how I can have, and how really anybody can have, objective morality and ethics. How can you be an ethical person without having some source of right and wrong outside the physical universe? In other words, I'm going to prove that you can be good without God. That's what C.S. Lewis tried to do. Well, he tried to do it, but he failed. He wasn't able to pull this off. He said it can't be done. All he succeeded in doing, really, was convincing himself that there is something outside of the material universe. It has to be there. And he talked about this in Mere Christianity, in these radio lectures, which became the book. Now, at this point, talking about good and evil, he said, I'm not yet within 100 miles of the God of Christian theology. I'm not even close to Christianity yet, but that's not what I'm talking about right now. I'm just talking about good and evil, right and wrong. Do they exist? And if so, why? You're listening to The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio, 1-888-914-9149. If you have a take on any of this, what I'm saying about C.S. Lewis, right and wrong, good and evil, as a clue to the meaning of the universe. Well, once C.S. Lewis realized that something else does exist besides the material universe, this concept of right and wrong, they're real things, he had to figure out, well, what is this? What might this be? Well, it can't be brute matter, so it has to be something spiritual. It would have to be something like a mind, because it has values, and it has to be good, not just powerful. There has to be goodness involved. And so he thought about that, and then he also realized that the values that he thought were really important in life, the ethics that he thought were crucial, there were times that he didn't measure up personally to those ethics, to those values. And he explained this later in his radio talks and in the book, that we know from our own experience that there is a moral law. There is something called right and wrong. We know that it exists, and we also know something else. We don't always keep it. We don't always hold up to our own standards of what we think right and wrong are. Well, in 1942, as part of these radio broadcasts, he explained a little bit further of how he got to this belief in God. Well, he said, okay, I'll admit that there's some sort of mind that's out there that exists. All right, well, how do you get from this sort of impersonal mind that might be the source of good and evil to what we might call a personal God? Well, in 1924, when he first started thinking about this, as he was substitute teaching philosophy, he was sort of looking around with different religions, and he first thought about going for pantheism. And pantheism is kind of this view that God contains both good and evil. So a lot of different forms of Hinduism would postulate this. But then Lewis kind of said, that didn't really work. It doesn't take evil seriously. So we've got to try another approach. And he really didn't want to go the Christian route. He really didn't want to go down that road. So he turned to dualism. He said, pantheism's not going to work, so I'm going to go with dualism. And he once said this. He actually said this in Mere Christianity. And here's a quote from him. I personally think that next to Christianity, dualism is the manliest and most sensible creed on the market. But it has a catch. It has a catch. Well, what's the catch? Well, in a dualist system, the concept is that there are two different gods, two gods who are sort of equal in power, and they're eternally in opposition to one another. This is where Taoism gets this idea of the eternal struggle between evil and good. And they just can't see, neither side can really vanquish the other side. The yin and the yang, they're constantly in opposition. equal in power, but opposite in nature, good and evil. There's a God of good, and there's a God of evil. I guess you could say this is sort of a Star Wars theology, too. There's the dark side of the Force, and then there's the good side of the Force, and they're kind of fighting against each other. But that's not the Christian view at all. And so the catch in this idea that Lewis recognized, this concept of dualism, why it doesn't really work, that there are equal forces of good and evil opposing each other. He said, well, if they're really equal, if there's a sort of a good God and evil God, well, then there's no reason to call one of them good and the other one evil. How can you say that? How can you say one is good and one's evil if they're equally powerful? Unless there's some separate power or some separate quality that's above both of them that judges between what's good and what's evil. How do you know what's right or what's wrong? Well, that power, that higher power, if you will, would be the real God. That's an interesting thought. So without this ultimate overarching basis for judging between good and evil, they wouldn't be bad or good. They'd just be different. The evil God would say the good God is bad, and the good God would say the evil God is bad. That doesn't make any sense. And so Lewis is like, okay, that's not going to work. There has to be a single good God who is responsible for the moral law and also responsible for letting us become aware of this moral law. There's something that's going on here between this spiritual God and the physical universe. How is it that people in the physical universe can figure out that there is good and evil? So, again, as C.S. Lewis said, we're still a million miles away from believing that this God actually became human, took on flesh, entered into the material world, dwelt among us as Jesus of Nazareth. And so in Mere Christianity, he doesn't talk about that. One of his other books, Surprised by Joy, he does talk about that, where he was when he came to believe that Jesus is actually God the Son. But in Mere Christianity, he just talks about how he figured out the link between, okay, there must be a God, and then how do you get to basic Christianity? So the main point, and this is the argument that everybody remembers from Mere Christianity, is what Jesus said about himself. And when you look at what Jesus said about himself in the Gospels, C.S. Lewis said you're really stuck with only three options. Jesus is either liar, lunatic, or Lord. He's either a lunatic, a crazy person, as C.S. Lewis says, on the same level as the guy who says he's a poached egg. He's nuts. He says he's God, but he's just badly mistaken. He's not all there. Got a few loose screws up there. Or this is really demonic. He's saying, I'm God. The only way to heaven is through me. I and the Father are one. Now, he's saying this and he knows it's not true, in which case it would be demonic. Or it really is true. It really is true. He really is the living Lord. I am the way, the truth, and the life, and no one comes to the Father except through me. John 14:6. So a lot of people in this culture, back then, even today, they want to say, well, Jesus is a good teacher, but I'm not ready to say that he's God. And C.S. Lewis in the book, he says, that's not an option. That's not an option for you. He's either lunatic, liar, or Lord. He's not a good teacher if what he's teaching about himself is not true. If he says that I'm the way to God, and he's not, he's either crazy or he's a very bad man, unless it is actually true. And where did he get this idea from, liar, lunatic, or Lord? He actually got it from the Catholic convert G.K. Chesterton. And G.K. Chesterton, he wrote a book called The Everlasting Man in the year 1925. And Chesterton talked about this in that book. And C.S. Lewis read that book, and he just could not get it out of his brain. And that's really what got into what became Mere Christianity. So this is really these talks on the radio in the 1940s on the BBC, which became this book, Mere Christianity, that really was his testimony, how he got to that point, how he got to that point. So I thought that was really fascinating because the power of testimony is really, really important. We've talked a lot about on this program, this idea of sharing your story, and everybody's story matters. What God is doing in your personal life matters, and you can tell that to others. That can encourage them. Side bonus, nobody can say it's not true. God is doing this in my life. This is what's someone going to say to you? Oh no, you're making this up. No, they'll usually listen. If you're talking about what you think are objective facts, you might get an argument, but Nobody can really argue with a personal testimony. Well, C.S. Lewis never officially gave one, but he did in his book, Mere Christianity. And we can talk a little bit more about that after the break if you want. You can call me 1-888-914-9149. We're going to talk after the break about lots of stuff. The Ark of the Covenant, Raiders of the Lost Ark. Did you know that the Ark is actually a piece of furniture? What? I'll explain. Plus, I'm going to tell you why after this, our exile, Mary will show us the fruit of her womb. Jesus, what's our exile? Are we in it right now? More coming up on the Cale Clark Show. Be right back.
Explaining the faith so you can explain it to others. It's the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
So what's really at the back of the difficulty is this idea of God having to fit too many things into one moment of time. Well, that of course is what happens to us. Our life comes to us moment by moment. One moment disappears before the next comes along.
Nope, I didn't change my voice just there and cop a British accent. That was actually audio from C.S. Lewis and his famous BBC radio talks, which eventually became the book, Mere Christianity. Hey, why don't you call in 1-888-914-9149? What's your favorite C.S. Lewis book, if you have one? Maybe it's the Narnia series. Maybe you're into the fantasy stuff. I'm not into that. I have to confess. I know Lucas is probably listening to me in the car right now as he's driving. He's crying because he's into Lord of the Rings. I must confess, I haven't read Lord of the Rings.
You haven't read it?
Bad Catholic.
I agree with Lucas, Cale.
I've seen the movies. Does that count?
Not really. No.
It's kind of a cheat code.
No.
So anyways, folks, if you're listening, you can call in and tell me, what is your favorite C.S. Lewis book? Is it one of the fantasy series, like that Hideous Strength or the Narnia series, The Chronic? What? Cools of Narnia. Bonus points if you get that reference. But having said that, it might be Mere Christianity or The Abolition of Man. Maybe we're going to be talking about that next week with Father Michael Ward. Even Patrick Aylog, he went to Costco, he was telling me during the break, and he picked up a nice boxed set of C.S. Lewis books. So run, don't walk, to your local Costco, because they've got a box set on sale, one of the many fun items that you can find at your local Costco. But yeah, Mere Christianity is a great book. And again, C.S. Lewis never became Catholic, but he hung out with J.R.R. Tolkien, and his writing was very Catholic-friendly in a lot of ways. He definitely believed in Eucharistic realism, and of course, as an Anglican, he wouldn't have had access to the real Eucharist, but he believed in the concept of the Eucharist. He believed in a male ministerial priesthood. He believed in auricular confession, among many other things. And this whole concept of mere Christianity, of course, I've talked about this on the show before too. It's a little bit problematic because how do you know what mere Christianity is? C.S. Lewis kind of calls it the very, very basics, the basics that you need to believe to be a Christian. But who gets to decide, you know, how many things are the basics? How long is that list? And he says that really mere Christianity just sort of gets you in the door, gets you in the vestibule. It gets you in the front door, but you have to pick a room to live in, and he calls them, those rooms, the various churches that are out there, or Protestant communities. You got to pick one, the one that you think is the right one. Well, we would say it's the Catholic Church, and we would say that it's not a choice that you get to make necessarily. You just got to realize that Christ founded the Catholic Church, and he wants everybody to be in it. But having said that, C.S. Lewis can still produce a lot of arguments that any Catholic defender of the faith can use to draw people to the truth. And I just wanted to explain a little bit about, in just a touch more detail, what I was talking about earlier, this idea of good and evil in the universe as a tip-off to the fact that there is a God. In Mere Christianity, he starts with something that seems a little bit off topic. He says, everyone has heard people quarreling. Everyone has heard people fighting or arguing. True, it's a common human experience. Then he starts saying, well, here's some of the things that people say when they feel that they've been mistreated or wronged. They say stuff like, how would you like it if anyone did the same to you? Or, come on, you promised. And C.S. Lewis says in the book, "What interests me about all these remarks is that the person who makes them is not merely saying that the other guy's behavior doesn't happen to please me. He's appealing to some kind of standard of behavior, which he expects the other person to know about." And the other guy never says, "To heck with your standard." Now, he says it a little bit more stringently and strongly and a little bit more colorfully in the book. But the other guy never says, "To heck with your standard. What this moral standard that you're appealing to of right and wrong or fairness. Forget it. There is no such thing." Nobody ever says that. And even children say this to each other. "That's not fair. Where are they getting this from?" So now, a lot of people today might say, well, C.S. Lewis's argument might have worked back in the 1940s during these radio talks that he was giving that turned into the book, but to heck with your moral standard, that's exactly what a modern person on the street might say today. We now live in, of course, what Pope Benedict XVI called the dictatorship of relativism. There is no such thing as objective universal truth to a lot of people. But we can't seem to get away from this idea. Even saying there is no objective truth, people who say that, they think it's true. They think it's a truth statement. So we can't really escape the concept of truth. So nobody actually lives that way. In reality, no, even if somebody says, "I'm a moral relativist," they don't actually live this way in reality. Tim Keller, who's another famous Protestant, he has a Presbyterian church in New York City that he pastors. He's written a lot of best-selling books. One of them is called The Reason for God. And Tim Keller works a lot with millennials in New York City. And here's what he says. "People in our culture are constantly complaining that young people are relativistic and that they're amoral." And he says, "Look, I've been neck deep dealing with sophisticated 20-somethings for almost 2 decades, and I have not found this to be the case. Not in Manhattan, anyways. The secular young adults that he knows, he says, they have a very highly honed sense of right and wrong. And there are a lot of things happening in the world that evoke their moral outrage." So again, back to C.S. Lewis here in Mere Christianity. He says, "The most remarkable thing is this." He says, "Whenever you find a man who says he does not believe in a real right and wrong, you will find the same man going back on this a moment later. He might break his promise to you, but if you try breaking one to him, he'll be complaining it's not fair before you can say Jack Robinson. A nation may say treaties do not matter, but then the next minute they spoil their case by saying that the treaty they want to break was an unfair treaty. But if treaties don't matter, and if there is no such thing as right and wrong, in other words, if there is no law of nature, what is the difference between a fair treaty and an unfair one? Have they not let the cat out of the bag and shown that whatever they say, they really do know the law of nature just like anyone else?" And he puts "law of nature" in caps, capital letters to begin, "law of nature." So this is a thing. This is called the universal moral law, a real right and wrong. So at the end of the day, C.S. Lewis wanted his readers and his listeners on the radio to understand 3 things. Number one, there is a moral law, a universal moral law that applies to everybody, whether they believe in it or not, whether they say they believe in a moral law or not, they appeal to it all the time. When they're the victim, when somebody else doesn't obey the moral law, and then they want to excuse themselves when they don't obey it personally. And that leads us to the next thing. So the second thing C.S. Lewis wants us to know is that all of us are, or have been, or will be, at some point, breakers of the moral law. This is sin. And only people who are truly delusional, or they never examine their consciences, never even think about the concept of, did I do something wrong? Those are the only kinds of people who would even try to deny this. And then the last point, and again, C.S. Lewis doesn't really talk about this, the existence of this universal moral law that everybody appeals to at some point, or falls short of at some point. If there's a universal moral law, that strongly implies that there is a universal moral law giver, which we would call God, but we're not quite there yet. That's why he said, we're not yet within 100 miles of the God of Christian theology. So, I mean, later on he does talk about Jesus, but this is the starting point. And really, again, the reason why he brought this up was it was the starting point for him. This is how he started his own personal journey. And it's a great way that we can engage secular people, and we're starting to talk about ultimate reality with them, this concept of the universal moral law, because everybody would say that there's right and wrong. Now, they might try to draw the line in different places, but I think just about everybody would agree that grabbing an assault weapon and mowing down a bunch of children at a school or in a park, and tragically that's happened far more often than we want to ever think about, most people would say that's wrong. But they'll sort of move the line if there's something that they want to do that they're involved in, that other people might say, well, this is not moral. But everybody does agree that there is such a thing, and that's a good starting point for conversation, I think. You're listening to The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio, 1-888-914-9149. You can follow me on Twitter at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. Well, Mary from Chicago called in at the end of the show yesterday, and I only had a brief moment to begin answering her question, but I wanted to do her justice. So, Mary, if you're listening, let's get back to your question. And your question was, what does it mean in the Hail Holy Queen prayer when we pray, after this our exile, show unto us the blessed fruit of thy womb, Jesus? What does this really mean? What is our exile? What is this all about? Well, the thing I said yesterday, and we only had a few seconds, so I gave her part one of the answer, and it was simply this, that our part of our exile is just that we're exiled from paradise because of sin. We're exiled from the conditions that Adam and Eve found themselves in before the original sin, and they got kicked out of the Garden of Eden. You can go to the Genesis series on the Faith Explained program on Relevant Radio and find out all about it. We dealt with all of that, you know, the flaming sword of the cherubim that kept them from trying to go back in and access the fruit of the tree of life. You don't want to live forever in this fallen state. Trust me on that one. Yeah. In that sense, death is a bit of a mercy because we need to be redeemed. We need to be redeemed. And so that's part one. We're sort of living in this exile of fallen humanity, a world in which, yes, Christ has come back. He's come into the world, and he has set the conditions for us to get in on eternal life. But at some point, the second coming of Christ is going to happen. And when that happens, then the new heavens, the new earth, I can't wait, get a resurrection body. We're going to get back to that state. And the exile, if you will be over. But now we're kind of in this place of soul making in the world today. And that's part of why God allows these things to happen. So he allows human freedom, essentially. And sometimes people use their freedom to make bad choices, and that is sin. But there's something else when it comes to after this, our exile, show unto us the blessed fruit of thy womb, Jesus. This actually has something to do with the Bible. And it's something that happened in the Gospel of Matthew. After the death of John the Baptist, it says that Jesus went back into Galilee. And here's what it says. And this is Matthew chapter 4, starting with verse 12. Now, when Jesus heard that John had been arrested, he withdrew into Galilee. And leaving Nazareth, he went and dwelt in Capernaum by the sea, in the territory of Zebulun and Naphtali, that what was spoken by the prophet Isaiah might be fulfilled. And then Matthew here quotes Isaiah chapter 9, the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali towards the sea, across the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles, the people who sat in darkness have seen a great light. And for those who sat in the region and shadow of death, light has dawned. From that time, Jesus began to preach, saying, repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Now, if you read that little passage in Matthew's gospel and you don't know the context, the background of the Old Testament, it's going to make some sense, but you don't have the fullness of what's really going on. And it has to do with the exile. Well, what was really interesting is that King David, when he was king of Israel, he ruled over all the 12 tribes. And guess what? Two of the tribes, they were called Zebulun and Naphtali. These are, of course, the 12 tribes of Israel, the sons of Jacob. Again, in our Faith Explained series on Genesis, we kind of gave you the background of all that. And God promised to King David, your dynasty will last forever. And the Israelites assumed that, hey, that was going to include all the tribes. But guess what happened? In the year 740 BC, the Assyrians invaded, and they took away 10 of the 12 tribes of Israel into, guess where? They were sent into exile. Oh, by the way, What were the first two tribes that were taken by the Assyrians? You guessed it. The tribe of Zebulun and the tribe of Naphtali. So when Isaiah in chapter 9 says that, hey, the land of Zebulun, the land of Naphtali, people that sat in darkness, a light has dawned. And then, of course, by the way, in Isaiah chapter 9, it's that famous passage about the Prince of Peace. A child will be born to us. We read this a lot during the Advent season, Christmas season. A child will be born to us, and the government will be upon his shoulders, and this will be his name, Wonderful Counselor, Everlasting Father, Mighty God, Prince of Peace. And that's seen as a prophecy, of course, about Jesus, who is all these things. And so this has to do, though, with the exile, Zebulun, Naphtali, those are the first two tribes that got taken off into Israel. And so two of the tribes remained, and one of them became the biggest tribe, Judah. And that's where the name the Jews come from, Judahites, members of the tribe of Judah. And it came, of course, to, in time, it came to cover all the Israelites, became known as the Jews. And the tribe of Judah was located in the south, where Jerusalem was, and where David's kingdom was sort of located, headquartered. So 598 BC, something else happened. The Babylonians, they also took tribes into Israel, the last two tribes, Judah and one more tribe. And so now all the tribes are in exile. And it seems like God's promise to David, hey, you'll always have somebody sitting on the throne, this kingdom of David will last forever. That's looking pretty bleak right now. Maybe God can't keep this promise. That's what the people were thinking. Well, eventually, the exile came back, was over, and those two tribes did come back. The tribe of Judah came back, but 10 of the 12 tribes of Israel never came back. And that's why they're called the Lost Tribes of Israel. Maybe you've heard about this. These are the 10 tribes that got taken into exile, and they never came back. Side note, this is one of the reasons for the mission to the Gentiles. Jesus said, go into all the world and preach the gospel. Start here in Jerusalem. It's kind of like the middle of the bullseye. And then go out in these concentric circles out into the world, to Samaria, and then to all the ends of the earth. Why? Why did St. Paul? Why was he the apostle to the Gentiles? Well, guess what? What happened to those 10 tribes? Well, eventually people think they basically started intermarrying with the people around them, and they assimilated into the Gentile peoples out there in all these various lands. So they were still kind of out there, just nobody knew who they were, where they were. But they're still kind of out there in the Gentiles. So really, going out to the Gentiles and preaching the gospel to them is a way of regathering all of Israel together in the one church. How about that? So this is the context of Jesus stepping into the scene in the gospel. The Jews, they're not necessarily in exile, but they are being oppressed by foreign control. The Roman Empire has taken over the Holy Land. They've got them under their thumb. How is God going to get them out of this? He has to send the Messiah. He's got to restore the kingdom of David. Well, then, this is exactly where and when Jesus starts preaching. And where does he do it? It's where Zebulun and Naphtali used to be located. Those two tribes, they lived in that region of Galilee where Jesus says, I'm going to set up shop here in Capernaum, the land of Zebulun, the land of Naphtali, and let the reader understand, I'm doing this for a reason. So how about that? And what's Jesus' message? He starts preaching, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Well, what was the kingdom of David called? It was called, in the Old Testament, it was called the kingdom of God. And Matthew's a very Jewish gospel. Matthew doesn't want to use the name of God, so he says, oh, the kingdom of heaven. It's kind of a nice way of saying God. They don't want to use that name of God, Yahweh, the tetragrammaton. YHWH means I am. It's from Exodus 3 when God reveals himself to Moses. So what's Jesus saying here? Hey, there's been a really, really long exile, but it's going to end now. Oh, and by the way, I'm going to call 12 disciples. Ooh, that's not accidental. 12 disciples, 12 apostles, 12 tribes of Israel. I'm restarting the whole thing here. I'm regathering Israel. I'm starting something called the church. And it's not just for Israelites. It's for everybody. So I think that's a little bit in the background when we ask Mary to look on us, pray for us, and after this, our exile, show us the fruit of your womb, Jesus. When we're all at home in the true kingdom of God in heaven, together with her, and of course, her divine son, Jesus. How about that? Hope that's a good answer to your question, Mary. Hope it sheds a little bit more light. You're listening to The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio, 1-888-914-9149. I'll be right back. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester. Hey, welcome back to the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. You know what that Indiana Jones music means. I told you I was going to talk about the Lost Ark. Raiders of the Lost Ark, venerators of the Lost Ark. And we know that Mary is the Ark of the New Covenant, because what made the Ark so holy, after all, in the Old Testament? Well, it wasn't so much that it was made out of acacia wood and overlaid with gold and these beautiful angels that were on top, the mercy seat, as it was known, where the presence of God, the Shekinah glory of God dwelt. Yes, those are all wonderful things, but what made the Ark so holy was, other than the presence of God there, of course, but what was inside of it? There was, of course, the priestly staff of Aaron, which miraculously sprouted. There was a jar of the manna, the miracle bread that God used to feed the Israelites on their journey to the Promised Land. Of course, there were the Ten Commandments, the stone tablets in which the finger of God wrote. Well, Mary, what did she contain in her body? The Word of God made flesh, not on stone tablets, a person, Jesus of Nazareth, God the Son. And of course, he is the true manna, the Eucharist. He gives us his body and blood to sustain us on our journey to our promised land of heaven. And of course, he is the true heavenly high priest. So what Aaron's priesthood was just a prefigurement of the high priesthood of Jesus. So yeah, Mary's the Ark of the New Covenant. But I want to talk about the old Ark for just a second. Why did it look the way that it did? Why was it this box with these rings on the side and poles that would be pulled through and people would carry the ark? Why is it that the angels had these wings facing each other? Well, David Falk, who's a biblical scholar, deals a lot with Egypt in the Bible. He teaches at the Vancouver School of Theology, wrote a little piece in the Biblical Archaeology Review magazine about this. And he sort of put the ark in its Egyptian context. And really, this has to do with the Ark of the Covenant. Really comes to us from the period known as the Late Bronze Age, if you know your history epochs, if you will. And that's from 1500 BC to 1200 BC. And David Falk says that people at that time, they believed in all kinds of things. Snake spirits that would spit fire, gods wandering the land, demons that were trapped. And it was in this environment that Moses introduces the Ark of the Covenant. And David Falk says that really what happened with the Ark was that a lot of these concepts that the Israelites would have known about and seen while they were hanging out in Egypt, and they weren't hanging out because they wanted to be there, they were enslaved in Egypt, but they got very used to the way the Egyptians did things. The Ark takes a lot of Egyptian concepts and flips them upside down to make a new meaning about what God is doing. All right, so we don't understand why the Ark looks the way that it did. And I tweeted out on my Twitter account, at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. You can follow me there on Twitter. There's a little image, a picture of what the Ark looked like, what we think it looked like. And it looks a little bit strange to us, as I said. And if you've seen Raiders of the Lost Ark, you know it as well. But ancient people knew exactly what it meant, why it looked the way it did. And what David Falk tells us is that really the Ark, it's a piece of furniture. What? I've never thought about it like this before. He says it's like a piece of furniture. But you can't get this kind of furniture at Pottery Barn. Now, how is it furniture? Well, what is furniture after all? We all know what it is, but let's just define it exactly. Furniture is a piece of large, movable equipment that makes a space suitable for living or for working. So, for example, if you've got an empty room, that's not very useful, but if you put a chair in there, guess what? ta-da, you've now got a sitting room. If you put a bed in an empty room, you've got a bedroom. If you put a religious altar in there, you've got a ritual space. So furniture, what furniture does, it helps to define what a space really is. And so in the ancient Near East, really the land, the part of the world where the Bible really came to us from, furniture was a big deal. It was a status symbol. If you had a bed, if you had a chair, if you had a box to store your stuff in at the foot of your bed, that was a high-end luxury good, and only a few people could afford such things. Now, the very best furniture, as scholar David Falk explains, the very best furniture was used for the gods, donated to the gods, if you will. But it can't just be ordinary furniture. It's got to look really, really good. So you've got to decorate it. It's got to be good enough for God. We want to give him our best. Well, even the pagans did that for their pagan gods. And so in ancient Egypt, there would be these friezes. I don't know how to pronounce that word, but you know what I mean. It's like a horizontal decorative panel, if you will. And they would put these cobras on the panel, these carved cobras that would spit fire. And there would be a vulture goddess. And in between the wings of the vulture goddess, that was considered a holy space. And what the Egyptians would do is they would even create a sacred space inside of a sacred space. It's almost like creating a holy of holies like we have in the Jerusalem temple. And so there's all kinds of different furniture mentioned in the Bible. Biblical Hebrew has this word called tebah, which is a word that actually comes to us from Egyptian. It's loaned into Hebrew, and it means a basket or a box. If you go to the Egyptian Museum in Cairo, and I've actually been there on one occasion, it's one of the world's greatest museums, you can see these things. You can see these tebah, these baskets, these boxes. And it was that kind of basket or box that Moses was put inside and floated on the reeds of the river in Exodus chapter 2, the river Nile. And that's also the word that's used for the construction of Noah's Ark is this word tebah, which means a great big box. And so that's a little bit of a clue as to what the Ark of the Covenant might be. That's why it has this box shape to it, if you will. But that's not all. That's not all. David Falk, he also talks about something called an Aron. And that's different. And they have these in the museums in Egypt as well. For example, in the Egyptian Museum in Cairo, they have examples of these. And this is kind of like a chest. It's almost like a coffin, if you will, and it's on legs. And so this also has something to do with the Ark. There were these items called pega chests, and they're finely crafted pieces of furniture, and they would put over top of them a scarlet cloth. And guess what? The Ark of the Covenant was also covered in a cloth like this in Numbers chapter 4, verse 8. It talks about this. These sorts of chests were used in Egypt for storing holy or sacred items. Anyways, and finally, there's one more thing. There's something called the chest of Anubis, which is another type of long box. It looks a lot like the Ark of the Covenant. And on top of it is this Egyptian god, this false god, of course, but they worshipped this god called Anubis. And Anubis kind of looks like a Doberman pincher with really long ears, if you've ever seen this Egyptian god. And what was the job of this god Anubis? Well, Anubis would escort the dead to the afterlife. And they would have these images of this god on the lid on top of the box. It looks a little bit like the mercy seat on top of the Ark of the Covenant with these angels with their wings outstretched toward one another. Now, why would God want to make the Ark in such a way? Well, what he's doing is he's taking things that were known to the Israelites from their time in Egypt, and he's flipping it around. Say, they believed this stuff, but here's the truth. Here's the truth. And this is really what the book of Genesis does so many times in so many places. It takes things that the pagans believed about God and said, no. You think that this pagan god Baal is the one who rides on the clouds? No, Yahweh, the true God, is the one who's really the cloud rider. It kind of explains what the true God is doing using language that they understood from their world. This is really what it means. There's so much interesting stuff in this article in the Biblical Archaeology Review. And really what David Falk says at the end of it is that Yahweh is not bound to human limits, but he condescends to mankind. He explains himself in a way that we can understand. That's why he made the ark look like a little bit like the Egyptian furniture that they would have known about. Saying, okay, I get it, but this is about the true God, not these false gods. And this is really what the incarnation is all about too. God communicates to us in a way that we can really understand by becoming human, by becoming one of us. Go right back to mere Christianity there, where we started the show. Hope you've enjoyed the Cale Clark Show today. Patrick Alog produced, Jake Moore screened the calls. We'll be back tomorrow. Can't wait. Take it away, Michaela.
Thank you for listening to my daddy.